Welcome to the show. What's it like to be kidnapped? The confusion and fear. Who are these people? What's their intent? Are they going to hurt me or my family? Also the blame and self-doubt. What did I do wrong? I'm Greg Carino. I'm a former fighter pilot and a lawyer, and the mission of this show is to make you smart on the subjects of law and war by listening to the stories and lessons of those who fight in those arenas. It's winter 1981 in Verona, Italy. The Cold War is raging, and the communists are trying to overthrow the Italian government. They're kidnapping and killing people all over the country. My next guest has been through it. Major General James Lee Dozier is a retired U.S. Army officer who served 35 years. He worked in NATO. He also worked all over the U.S., Europe, and Asia. He was commissioned as an Army officer in 1956 following graduation from West Point. He earned a master's degree from the University of Arizona in aerospace engineering, and he's a graduate of the Command and General Staff College and the Army War College. During his time in Vietnam, General Dozier was awarded both the Silver Star and Bronze Star for heroism and the Purple Heart for combat wounds. In December 1981, he was kidnapped by the Red Brigade terrorists in Italy and held captive for 42 days before being rescued. General Dozier's conduct during his harrowing period was recognized by President Reagan with several invitations to the White House. General Dozier has written a book about his experience called Finding My Pole Star, and I'll link to that in the description. It is my honor to welcome Major General James Lee Dozier. General Dozier, thanks for joining me this morning. It's really an honor to speak with you. How are you doing out there in Florida?
It's my pleasure, Greg.
Well, good. So you're in Florida, so born and raised in Florida. Is that correct?
I was born in Arcadia, Florida. I was one of the few people that didn't complain about the weather in Vietnam. It was just like home.
I was going to say, like, if there's one place on Earth that has big bugs that can kill you, it would be Florida. Well, maybe the other one would be Vietnam. So I think you're correct on that front. I've had my experiences with the mosquitoes out in Florida in the summertime, and I think I deserve a Purple Heart for that TDY that I did. I was in a tent and probably got bitten 200 times by those mosquitoes out in Florida. So I respect you for having gone through that in both areas.
Some of them will haul you off.
Yeah. So let's just start from the beginning. So you were obviously raised in Florida and then went to West Point, had an incredible 35-year career, eventually became Major General. And we'll, of course, we'll talk about the kidnapping in Italy, which you have written a book about. Really an amazing life story. So what caused you to want to join the Army in the first place?
I would like to tell you it was out of patriotism. But the truth is, the social thing to do in my high school class was to join the Florida National Guard when you were 18. So I did. And this was during the Korean War, and one of the first units called up. And our job was to defend New York City against the North Korean Air Force. So,
wow.
We were 9mm anti-aircraft outfit.
Okay, so originally it was the National Guard that you joined?
Yes. And during summer training at Georgia, they replaced all of our National Guard officers and NCOs with regular Army officers and NCOs. And my new battery commander suggested, he got to know me, and he suggested that I apply for the civil service exam for the military academy. I did, made it, and ended up at Stewart Air Force Base, New York, at the prep school.
Okay. And then you decided to go to West Point somewhere in there. Is that correct?
I did.
Okay.
That's
all right.
It was sort of a circular route to get there, but I ended up there. And found out I liked
it. So were you a little older than most classmates when you entered West Point? Like, because you had a little prior enlistment there, so you didn't get there right out of high school.
I did not. I went to Mars Hill University in North Carolina for a year. Then went to the University of Florida for most of another year, and then they federalized my unit. So I was a little bit older. I barely made the under 22 criteria for West Point.
Okay, and did other cadets look up to you, or were you seen as sort of a leader among your classmates at that point, or what? Or were you all just trying to get through it together and just get through the pain?
The members who went to the West Point prep school were all in the military, and that cohort ended up at West Point, and we were looked to for leadership.
Okay.
The prior service.
Okay.
People.
Okay. Nice. And so when you're at West Point, you know, what were you thinking you wanted to do after that? Were you, did you just want to, you know, see where the Army took you, or did you have a career path in mind when you were there?
I didn't have a definite career path. My first objective was to survive plebe year and then to graduate.
Yeah, that seems common among a lot of the academy cadets and midshipmen, is just to survive. So I don't blame you for that one. You know, what was on the mind of most of your cadets at the time? Because I think you had said the Korean War was going on. In fact, well, it ended in 1953, and you were, I guess, a freshman at that point. So
I entered in 1952.
Okay.
And the Korean War lasted another year.
Okay. And did most of you believe that you were going to war after that? Or what was the sort of the mindset? Did you think that it was going to be over before you got there? Or was war on the mind of most people at the academy or at the West Point at that point?
The war was probably uppermost in cadets' minds, but there wasn't much concern about missing it.
Oh, like they felt that they were going to go.
If it continued.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's, I think that's different from a lot of folks. At least when I went to the Air Force Academy, you know, we were in a state of peace. So we thought it was just going to be, you know, puppy dogs and rainbows when we graduated. And of course, that turned out not to be the case with 9/11. So I do salute people who go to the academy and to West Point and to join the military knowing that they're already at war. So that's something.
So you're a grad of the Air Force?
Yes,
Academy.
I am. Yeah, 1997.
Well, congratulations. Yeah. I'm on our congressman's panel now that selects people for the service.
Oh, academy. Okay. So you interview the high schoolers and the, you know, folks that are entering the academy?
We interview people who usually high school seniors who want to attend an academy.
Okay. And this is a little bit off topic, but what are you looking for in those folks? Like, what are the characteristics you look for when you're selecting people to go to the academies?
We look for the whole person, not only academics, but athletics and community service primarily. Okay. And involvement in the community.
Right. I remember going and doing that interview myself, and it was pretty intimidating. You know, like you're talking to these older folks. They're in some cases war heroes like yourself. And do you have any recommendations for people who are doing their interviews?
Only with regard to the letters of recommendation. Get those letters from people who know you best, not just high-profile people, unless they really know you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because it could probably seem a little bit fake if it's somebody who doesn't know you.
We tell folks the most influential person in this room is the person being interviewed. The system we use takes the politics out of the nomination process.
Okay. That's good to know. Yeah, because I have a few friends that are applying to academies, or their kids are applying to academies, and they don't know what to expect or what to do. And I've heard that before, that it's the whole person that matters, and be honest, and, you know, don't try to fake your way.
By the way, the Merchant Marine Academy lets you graduate into any branch of the armed forces that you're interested
in. Oh, that's good to know. Okay, yeah, because people can change their minds.
So you can pass that off to them. It's a sleeper academy.
Yeah, I know. My grandfather was a Merchant Marine, so that's interesting. I never even thought about that. We always think about Army, Navy, you know, Air Force, but you got Merchant Marines. You also have Coast Guard as well, so I'm not sure what their process is, but that's good to know. Well, fantastic. Well, actually, I want to ask you about another person who was a classmate of yours was General Schwarzkopf. Did you ever know him personally?
He and I talked together in the mechanics department after we graduated. I did get to know him personally and his family.
Okay. What'd you think?
Well,
I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm kind of putting you on the spot.
He was a real warrior. And as a cadet, he exhibited those characteristics. And when we were teaching in the mechanics department, he took a year off to go to Vietnam and then came back highly decorated. He was a real warrior.
Good. Yeah, he definitely with his leadership in the first Iraq War, the Gulf War, became a household name at that point. And you could tell that he was the type of guy that was, he bled Army, he was a soldier's soldier, it seemed like.
His dad was involved in the Lindbergh kidnapping.
Really? Tell me about that. I'm not familiar.
I think it was in New Jersey, but his dad was the pretty high up in the police hierarchy, law enforcement hierarchy in New Jersey, and was involved in the Lindbergh kidnapping.
Okay. I would have to look up that history. Obviously, you're talking about Charles Lindbergh. Yeah. I don't know what happened with that. I'm sorry.
Their baby, the Lindbergh baby.
Oh, they took his baby.
Charles Lindbergh baby.
Okay. Because he was that during World War II? Because he was kind of anti U.S. involvement in World War II. Did somebody kidnap his baby because of that, or was it something else?
I think the baby was about my age because my folks took me out to one of the local attractions here, and there were questions with regard to me to see if I fit the numbers on the Lindbergh baby. It was early in World War. It was in the early 30s.
Oh, is that early? Okay. Okay. Interesting. So his dad was involved with that. And then that's when I guess young Norman was instilled with the values of service and bravery and all those things, joins the Army and obviously does, very well in Vietnam and all the way through and becomes a general. And so, wow, that's pretty cool. So you had some service in Vietnam as well. Can you kind of tell me about that? Like what years you were in and how did that go? Cause I think you got a Purple Heart out of that. Can you kind of tell us about that incident?
Well, first of all, was in the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. It was commanded initially by the son of the World War II General Patton, George Patton Jr., or the fourth, depending on how you call it. Our motto was find the bastards and pile on. It was very aggressive. We went out looking for a fight, and usually we found it. And George Patton, much like his father, had what I call battle sense. And that's the instinct for doing the right thing at the right time in combat. And a lot of Americans are alive today because of George Patton's battle sense. He was one of my mentors.
That George Patton Jr. was?
Okay. Yes. We still get together once a year, and we call it the Patton Reunion. Not only worked for him in Vietnam, but was a brigade commander when he commanded the 2nd Armored Division.
Okay. And then, so what years were you on the ground in Vietnam?
68, 69.
Okay. Yeah, it's probably pretty, those are pretty tough years because the country was turning against the war. How did you feel about it? And, how did you deal with the public reaction in that time?
I didn't experience any of the anti-war sentiment until I got back in the Pentagon.
Okay.
Right after my tour in Vietnam, I went to the Pentagon and I didn't feel any personal anti-war sentiment, but the Pentagon was a target, and they had to move airborne troops and the Marines into the Pentagon as a precautionary measure. Remember, the blue flannel suit backlash. We lived in Arlington, Virginia, and on television one night, the cars were set afire one of the bridges, and a fellow stopped because of the fire on the bridge, and somebody threw a garbage can at him, and he got out and beat the hell out of him with an umbrella.
Wow. That was a tough time. So you said he beat the guy up on the bridge then?
Well, he beat the guy that threw the garbage can at him, beat him up with an umbrella. He got out of his car and started whacking on him with an umbrella.
An umbrella. Okay. It's one hell of an umbrella then. Wow. So it seemed like then you're, I guess, a little bit used to the, you know, the security threat environment. You know, because I guess the whole idea of terrorism was kind of new back then, I guess. And it, of course, it escalated in the 70s and then, you know, your capture in the 80s in Italy. Like, so going through the 70s, it seemed like it was a time when we were trying to, I guess, get through the Vietnam era. You know, it was a tough time because of the war, because of the, you know, the potential impeachment of Nixon and the, you know, what was the sentiment in the military throughout the career or throughout the 1970s? Was it kind of a time of, you know, rebuilding, or how would you characterize that time?
It was a time of rebuilding. Yeah. I was assigned to DesOps on what was called a red team. Our job was to look for weak points in any government procurement program. And it was a good process. I was in charge of what we called the DAPRs, the Department of the Army Program Reviews, where we would get the industry folks together with the military folks on any given program. We developed things such as the Apache helicopter, the M1 tank, Bradley fighting vehicle, the major programs, and our job was to shoot holes in whatever program approach there was. It was a good process.
Now you're opening a whole other can of worms here with the M1. Well, let's just talk about those ones today. Do you have any criticisms of the M1 or the Apache, or things that you liked about them? Because those are mainstays of the Army inventory now.
Well, they were very carefully put together. They were good programs, and they were designed to be continuously modified. And I subscribe to Aviation Week now, and they're still in use, and they continue to be modified.
Okay. I'm going to get to the incident in Italy here really quick, but because while I have you, I've always wanted to know this. Do you deal at all with the Air Force in terms of like close air support? Are you familiar at all with the politics between the Air Force and the Army with regard to close air support?
Probably not as familiar as I should be. My daughter spent 26 years in the Air Force. And she was a cop, and she enjoyed it.
Okay.
My son was in the Coast Guard, so the whole family got involved one way or the other.
Wow, a whole family of military folks. That's great. Yeah, I asked because that was a time when the Air Force was developing the A-10, which is what I flew for many years. And you know, of course, the A-10 is used in close air support to support the Army. And the whole reason it was developed was to, because the Army was trying to create the AH-56, I believe, the Comanche. And the Air Force didn't want the Army to, they wanted the money. So they created the A-10 to prevent the Army from creating the programs to provide their own close air support. So, you know, you having been in that, you know, with the program development, I thought you might have like a little bit of inside knowledge with how, you know, those programs were developed. But I mean,
I don't know much about the A-10 except that we really enjoyed having it. In Vietnam, the gunships were saved. They bailed us out a number of times.
Oh, nice. The, which was it, the 47? The C-47?
It started out as a C-47. Then 119s, and then finally C-130.
Oh, nice. Can you tell me about any missions that you did with them. That's interesting to me. I've not talked to anybody who's worked with gunships in Vietnam.
Well, when we got into a pickle, a firefight, we'd call for either fast movers or gunships, depending on what the situation was. And the gunships were just great.
Which one did you like better, the fast mover or the gunship?
I think the gunships were more accurate. I was involved in one project using 2,000-pound bombs for close air support. And the Air Force came up with a program to clear bamboo, which is tough. So we welded a 50 caliber barrel, machine gun barrel, to the front of the bomb to give it some standoff so it would explode and hopefully clear the bamboo. And if you've never been in the vicinity of a 2,000-pound bomb going off, you're fortunate. Yeah. Unfortunately, I was in a helicopter during those trials, and it's quite a shock for a little bird like that in a 2,000-pound bomb.
Oh, my goodness. So you would attach a gun barrel to the front of the bomb so that the gun barrel would hit the ground first and then cause the bomb to...
We'd attach to the fuse of the
bomb. Wow.
And that would let it detonate above the ground and clear the bamboo.
Oh, wow. So it'd give it like an airburst capability because it's detonating just a few feet above the ground.
That was the idea.
It's amazing the ingenuity. So now they have these, you know, proximity sensors that are on the front of the bomb to do that. But you created your own prox fuse by just simply attaching a big gun barrel. I'm surprised that...
Yep. If it's a problem, a GI will figure it out.
That's the quote of the day right there. I'm going to put that on the front. If it's a problem, the GI will figure it out. That's great. I did not know that. That's ingenious. So you get through Vietnam and you're going back. You're back at the Pentagon now. Actually, real quick, I didn't ask you, but did you get the Purple Heart in Vietnam?
I did. I was standing with a small group watching tanks attack VC in a hedge line. And something exploded in the middle of the group. I was the only one hit. So George Patton was there, and he medevaced me in his own helicopter. I just had a frag wound arm. Wasn't a real big deal.
Well, it's but you being there is a pretty big deal. Did Colonel Patton ever talk about his relationship with his dad, with General Patton?
He didn't talk about it much in Vietnam, but during the Patton reunions in later years, we talked quite a bit about it.
Yeah. What did he say about his dad? I imagine the guy was a pretty much a hard ass, but anything?
Yeah, he was, but he also had battle sense. In the Military Officers Association of America magazine this month, there is an article about the problems that Eisenhower had with Patton, some of which I knew about, a lot of which I did not know about.
Yeah, and from what I know, just as a casual observer, is that Patton was aggressive and didn't always follow orders, said what was on his mind, maybe embarrassed the leadership at times. Was that about accurate?
I think that's accurate, at least according to this article. Yes.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
But he was a great guy to work for. He was a soldier.
Yeah, his father and son, is that correct?
Both of them.
That's good to hear.
Miss Patton is still alive, but George Jr. died of Lewy body disease. But Miss Patton's still alive.
Oh, wow. That's great. Where does she live? What state?
In Connecticut,
way up north. Okay. Well, cool. Well, so you get through the time, in through the 70s, and now, just to kind of set the table for the incident in Italy, we have Operation Eagle Claw in the 1979. That was the attempted rescue of the hostages in Tehran, which was failed. I think it was like eight service members were killed, or four. I think it was eight that were killed, and then another four that were injured. A couple of helicopters lost, airplanes as a disaster. And I think out of that, we were trying to create a more robust hostage rescue system. Of course, terrorism is becoming more of a big deal. And then you get assigned to Italy. And from what I gather, you're the deputy chief of staff for the NATO.
Admin and logistics. Okay. Something I was ill-equipped for. But persevered.
Okay, yeah. Tell me about just the assignment and how you felt going in. How did you get the assignment?
Our sink was Italian. I was assigned to the land component of the Southern Command of NATO. And it was predominantly, the land component was predominantly an Italian command. The higher headquarters was in Naples and was commanded by Admiral Bill Crowell, who later got promoted. But I went to language school to learn Italian. Didn't learn it very well. I learned more from my driver than I did in language school. I enjoyed the tour.
Yeah.
It gave me an insight that I had never had with regard to NATO.
Oh.
And NATO's a first-class organization. I was proud to be part of it. I had been assigned to Germany several times before, and I'd patrol the east-west German border in cavalry units. But the job in Italy gave me a perspective I hadn't had before. It was a great alliance.
Yeah, still. Oh, I know. And I know people are questioning it now, which is crazy to me. But now maybe not so much because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But just to kind of back up, though, when you patrolled East and West Germany, could you tell a difference between, obviously, you know, now it seems so stark, the difference between communism and the more free market Western capitalism. Like, could you notice that back then? Like, was there a big difference between East Germany and West Germany? Could you see, did you have much interaction with the Eastern Germans?
I made several trips to Berlin and got a chance to see East Berlin and the Potemkin villages and all the facades and whatnot. But there was a stark difference between East and West Germany.
Yeah, even back then, there was a difference.
Even back then.
Okay. Yeah, I visited Berlin, in 97, after I graduated from the academy. And of course, it was opened up at that point. The wall was down, but it was like going back in time. I mean, it was easily 30 to 40 years behind the West. I mean, it was really something to behold. So you get down to the NATO assignment, and you said that there were some parts of NATO that surprised you. Like, what did you expect about it? And what did you find that was different? Like, what did you learn as you started that assignment about NATO?
Well, my first tours in Germany were in the 60s, then again in the early 70s. And I was looking at it from the ground up. And I sort of got an overhead view when I was assigned to one of the NATO headquarters. And one of my regrets is that the various members of NATO were not contributing the way they should, and with regard to their GDP. Mm. And I think the goal was 2%, and some of them did, some of them didn't. And the heavy lifting was left up to us.
Yeah. Did you find that there was some, I'm sure there was just some complacency on the Allies' part. Like, maybe they were just tired of war. Oh, and here comes the U.S. to kind of take the load off of us. Were they kind of war tired, or do you think it was just people being people?
Well, I'm not sure, but if you join the team, you got to pull your weight.
Yeah, exactly. So now you're in Italy now. How long had you been there before, you know, the incident happened, the kidnapping? Were you there for many months, or did it happen pretty quickly?
I was there about a year and a half before.
Oh, it was a while. Okay. And then what was life like during that year and a half? I'm sure there was probably, you know, it was probably pretty casual then. And then after the kidnapping, of course, it was much more focused on security. Was life during that year and a half pretty relaxed and fun? I mean, how was that assignment in the beginning?
I enjoyed the assignment. My wife and I both attended language school along with our daughter. Our daughter, language school is what caused my daughter to join the Air Force. She met a lieutenant out there who talked her into joining. And she was assigned to Rhine Mine when I was kidnapped. So she was immediately flown down to be with her mother. So it was a good life in Italy. And as a result, we've made friends that we still maintain contact with.
And what did you feel about the local population? What were their big political concerns? Because I know in Italy, the relationship with the between the Northern Italians and the Southern Italians is pretty contentious. Like, how did they feel about their internal politics? Because obviously with the Red Brigade, they're called what, Brigate Rossi? You know, that's a pretty intense terrorist organization.
Yeah.
You know, how was the local population? What was their politics like?
They were hot and cold. There are 26 distinct dialects that Italians speak. And some of the people in Northern Italy, if they speak in dialect, can't talk to the people in Southern Italy if they speak in dialect. Wow. But the government is smart. All the television and radio broadcasts and the newspapers are in High Italian in an effort to unite.
Oh, High Italian. That's what they call it. So if they all speak High Italian, I guess they can all understand each other. But you said dialects makes it very difficult.
Yeah. Okay. If the family speaks in dialect, that's not High Italian.
Okay.
German is not that way, too. Bavarians speak differently than Hochdeutsch.
What do you call it? Okay. Okay. Would you say that it's similar to, you know, like in the U.S., we have people with a New York accent and people with a Southern accent, but they can understand each other very easily. It's just an accent. But in Italy, like, they literally cannot understand each other if they speak in their dialect?
If they speak in dialect, the northern part of Germany used to be part of Austria. Northern part of Italy used to be part of Austria. And the southern was largely Greek and Roman.
Oh.
So, there are accents involved, and if you want to communicate, you've got to do it in High Italian.
Okay.
Northern Italy, a lot of the roadsides are in German.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Okay. Also, it is pretty. There are divisions. Wow. I want to get to the kidnapping, if you can do that now. So, I heard it was the plumbers that came in. You know, there are four plumbers, and they make their way in, which... Can you kind of go through that day and that moment and just kind of how you felt? I mean, imagine there was surprise, like you didn't know you were being kidnapped at first. Can you kind of just go through that day and what it was like?
Well, a little bit of background. The Russians installed SS-20 missiles in the Warsaw Pact. NATO had a plan to install cruise missiles in Sicily and Belgium. The Red Brigades, which was a communist organization, developed a plan to bring down the Italian government in order to prevent the cruise missiles from being installed in Sicily. And part of that plan was to kidnap high-ranking people in not only their own government, but also in Allied governments. They even planned to shoot down civilian airliners with surface-to-air missiles. There's a book called Winter of Fire that describes the plan. First of all, I had no indication that I was a target. We knew that the left-wing organizations up in Central Europe erupted and concentrated most of their ire in Germany, France, and Greece. But we knew that things were going on in Italy, but that Americans had not been targeted before. So I was eventually selected because I was an American and I was a member of NATO. They were the left-wing organizations were mad at NATO and, of course, the United States, because we were looked at as leaders of NATO. And we wanted to install the missiles. So that was the criteria. I fit because I was in a NATO job and also an American. So I became a target, but I didn't know that I was a target.
Okay. Yeah, so it was a surprise on many levels. And just to kind of give people a little bit of context, back then, not everybody had phones in their apartments or in their houses. I think they had said there was, I don't know, 40 or 50 families. I'm not sure what the number was, but on the order of dozens of families, but maybe only a quarter of them actually had telephones. So security required people checking in with each other, either physically or through signals of out their window, like having their shades pulled a certain length or whatever. So it was hard to maintain organization back then and hard to maintain security.
My driver was a member of the Carabinieri, which is a national police organization, paramilitary. And he kept his ear pretty close to the ground, but he didn't detect anything mm-hmm. either. It came as a surprise.
So on that day, then it was in the evening. I think it was like 6 p.m. when the actual kidnapping happened. So were you just coming home from work?
I had come home early in order to go to a community council meeting, a small American community there in Verona. And my wife and I were having a drink in the kitchen before the meeting. I was also the community leader of the small American community. We had an American high school or elementary school. The high school was in Vicenza. And there was a knock on the door, and our apartment was on the sixth floor. Also, we occupied a penthouse on top of the building. My wife was concerned because the downstairs doorbell had not rung. And I told her, don't worry about it, sort of famous last words. And I went to the front door and I asked who was there. And they said that there were plumbers and there's a leak in the apartment downstairs and they'd like to see if the water was coming from our unit. So opened the front door and there stood two young men. They looked like plumbers. They were dressed like plumbers. So I let them in. And we started checking the apartment for leaks and ended up in a washroom. And my wife had used the washing machine that day. So she followed us into the washroom. And then one of the two guys used a word in Italian that I didn't understand. So I told him, we need to go back to the kitchen where I keep an Italian-English dictionary, and I'll see what you're talking about. The guy who runs the interview program for our
okay.
He's another general.
Sounds like a Model T.
Anyhow, I was looking up the word in the dictionary, and all of a sudden, a guy landed on my back. I was spun around, and I was looking down the barrels of two solid pistols. And my wife dropped to her knees at about that time. And we had a fight, and I mm-hmm. lost. And I ended up on the floor outside of the kitchen, looked back in, and one of the guys had a pistol pointed at my Damn. Wife's head. That's when the fight yeah. was over. So to make a long story short, they loaded me into a trunk and hauled me off to Padova.
Wow. And again, just to provide more context, I think it was a year or two before that the Red Brigades had killed the former Italian prime minister. Yeah. So, yes. You know, did you know that it was the Red Brigades that had kidnapped you, or did you just think it was low-level thugs? I mean, what was going through your mind?
Well, they announced that we're the Red okay. Brigades. Siamo Brigate Rosse. And that was sort of reassuring to my wife, because apparently they wanted her to be able to tell folks who did this thing. And they gave us some early indications that they it was a kidnapping, not just a murder. So after they hauled me off, they took me to Padova, put me in a tent inside of a bedroom, and chained me to a bunk by an arm and a leg, and told me that they were going to put me on trial and to show Italians what a war criminal Americans are. And I rued the day that we inflated our award citations in Vietnam, because they used those as the basis for my war crimes.
Wow. Not many of us think about that. So we get these awards oftentimes for not doing much. I know most of my awards are for not doing much, but they will use those awards as a reason to show, oh, look how much this person has done, and therefore they are a war criminal. Yeah.
They ransacked my office and took a lot of my personal files, which caused me some problems a little bit later, particularly with regard to the income tax files.
Okay.
We'll get to that.
Oh, wow. Talk about a high profile and identity theft there. That's a tough one when you got the Red Brigades going after you. The IRS is tough enough. So now you're being taken somewhere. Did they tell you where they were taking you or how long you would be held captive? I mean, how much did you really know?
Actually, the tent inside of a bedroom is designed to do a couple of things. The guards sat in the outer part of the tent. You see a lot of, it's the same type of tent you see on beaches. It's a cabana type tent. It had flaps. The guards would sit in the outer portion of the tent, separated from me with a flap. And the guards were never armed. And we'll come back to that. But periodically, the leader of the group, Savasta, would come in and with a witness and put me on trial. And they tried to brainwash me. And they came in one day and handed me a 12-page typewritten treatise on the Red Brigades and said, read it. I skimmed it and threw it under the bunk. They came back and quizzed me on it, and I flunked. So one of the guys, Di Leonardo, sat down with me, and we used an Italian-English dictionary, and we translated that thing word for word. Would come to a passage that just made no sense to me whatsoever. And I would look up at Di Leonardo and ask him if he really believed this stuff. And he was
the guard?
He was one of the guys that shared guard duty. But he was a member of the Red Brigades, but he was their political theoretician. And when I questioned him about some of his beliefs, he was insulted. And finally, he told me after a couple of these sessions, if we can't convert you, maybe we can at least make you neutral.
Hmm. So they were actively trying to persuade you toward their beliefs.
They were trying to brainwash me.
And what did you say to the guard? So did you have like little debates with him about communism versus, you know, Western democracy and capitalism? Did you actually engage with him?
I did with Di Leonardo. But otherwise, what they said they wanted to do, using my awards from Vietnam, the write-up from the awards in Vietnam, was to show the Italian people what a war criminal I was. And later on, after I was rescued, I had a chance to talk to a former member of the Red Brigades and ask him what they planned to do with me. And he said it all depended on the cruise missiles. So I guess they would have kept me around until the cruise missile issue was resolved. If I hadn't been rescued.
Sorry, I wanted to back up just real quick about your conversations with, was it Leonardo? You know, what were they trying to convince you of? Obviously, that we talked about the war criminal part, but were they trying to convince you that communism was a good thing? Was it that level philosophical, or was it more about, hey, trying to convince you that you're a war criminal? Was it more about the war criminal, or was it more about communism?
With DiLeonardo, it was trying to convince me that the Red Brigades saw things in the proper way, that the American way was not the proper way. But for the Italian people, and this was part of their overall scheme to bring down the Italian government, they wanted to show that Americans really were war criminals.
Okay. Based on Vietnam.
Based on Vietnam. In my case, based on
Vietnam. Okay. And then
they wanted to topple the government so that the cruise missiles were not installed in the system.
Right. Okay. Now, so you were there for, I think, 40 some odd days, and you kept your mind occupied using solitaire, and you made a code of communication. Can you kind of talk about how you kept yourself sane during those days?
Well, I'm not sure I remain sane.
Understandably. But,
I developed a little alphanumeric code to keep track of what was going on. Initially, I was required to wear earphones through which awful recorded music was played. So I decided to organize my day so that I did the same thing at the same time every day. And pretty soon it worked. The guards didn't pay as much attention to me as had been, and I could listen to the traffic outside. So figured out I was in an urban area, the morning buildup of traffic, noontime rush hour, and finally the going home traffic. I was able to keep a diary based on the solitaire scores. Initially, I was scratching the solitaire scores into corrugated box top with my fingernails. So they brought me pencil and paper, and I kept them. As a result, I was able to keep a diary of what was going on. And at the end of the 42 days, I was 2 days off. They had a light bulb installed in the tent that they would change from blue to white in order to disorient me with regard to time. And once I could listen to the traffic outside, I was able to keep pretty good track of time. And I was 2 days off.
Yeah, so that's impressive. So you're inside of a tent and you got this light over your head, which prevents you from sleeping soundly. And you have constant horrible Italian music, which, you know, Italian music usually is pretty nice. So I'd like to hear what horrible Italian music sounds like. So they have that going. So you can't sleep. You have no idea what time of day it is. But through using what you had, which was listening to the traffic, you're able to keep track of time. And you're only 2 days off at the end. That's pretty impressive.
Actually, I was treated pretty well. Okay. They fed me three meals a day, nothing exotic, but I think I was eating the same thing that they were eating, a lot of canned food.
Now, did you ever attempt to communicate with the outside world, or did you have any contact at all with anybody other than the guards? I mean, I don't know how you would do that, but I mean, were you able to?
I did try to communicate with the outside world. As soon as they threw me in the tent, within a day or two, they came in with a sign that told me that they wanted to take a picture of me with a sign. And the sign just espoused all the chronicles of the Red Brigades. I told them I didn't want to do that. And they said, well, it doesn't make any difference. We'll just staple it to your chest. And so first way I tried to hold the sign was with a V in each hand. They said no. So I tried to hold it with my middle finger pointed towards the sign, and they said no. So they very carefully put my fingers on the sign. In one of their communiques, which they would release periodically, my wife was able to see my academy ring, which was the first time that she knew that I was still alive.
Okay.
A little story goes along with that. It took them four tries come up with a picture that's satisfied with. I let my beard grow, and sometime during the fourth or fifth week, DeLeonardo was the one that took the pictures. He came in and said, we want to take the pictures all over again. I asked him why, and he said, to show people that you're still alive. And asked him, how many times is it going to take this time? It took four times the first time. And he said, don't be a smartass. So guess what? It took four times for the second picture to be made. And again, my wife saw my Academy ring.
Now, was it ever on your mind like, hey, at some point they could kill me? Because they did kill the prime minister after like 50 some odd days. And here you are, you know, pushing 40 days. Was it ever on your mind like, hey, if we go much past 40 or 50, like, this could be it for me?
You come to grips with that. And I use the analogy of a professional football quarterback. You know you're going to get creamed, but you're trained to do what you're trained to do, either pass or hand it off, and you don't worry too much about getting creamed. So I had no training in how to behave in a situation like this, but I'd read a lot of POW stories. And you take it one day at a time. And the things that you can control, you control. The things you can't control, you don't worry about. And that's pretty much the criteria I use. But when I had a chance to talk to this former member of the Red Brigades after the kidnapping, he said it all depended upon the cruise missiles, what would happen to me.
Yeah. And I didn't research this, but what did happen with the cruise missiles? Because you were eventually rescued, but whatever happened with the cruise missiles?
I think they installed them in both Sicily and Belgium. My daughter was involved with security for the cruise missiles.
Okay. Now, what about the rescue itself? So can you kind of walk through the day that happened?
I was sitting on the bunk reading 1984 for the second time, and you're ever in jail and you want something uplifting to read, 1984. I would have read almost anything. I was given early on the international editions of Time and Newsweek, and also playing cards and some English language novels. 1984 was some of that. By the way, the international editions of Time and Newsweek, they would tear out the articles about the kidnapping in Italy, but they would forget to tear out the table of contents. So I read one of them they brought, talked about the massive manhunt in Italy. So I knew that people were looking for
it. Interesting.
Anyhow, on the day that I was rescued, I was sitting on the bunk reading 1984, and an arm reached through the outer flap of the tent and handed my guard with a pistol. But almost immediately, another figure burst through the outer flap of the tent and knocked the guard down. He got up and they knocked him down again. Then the guy pushed his way into my part of the tent, and I started pushing him out because I had learned previously that I thought I was caught up in with a rival faction of the Red Brigades, which contributed to the death of Aldo Moro, by the way. They weren't as cohesive as you might expect. So anyhow, I tried to push him out of the tent, and he kept telling me I'm a policeman. And finally, he pulled up his ski mask to show me his face, and it dawned on me he probably was a policeman the way he said it was. Then he said, we got to get you out of here, because we understand that the apartment's rigged for demolition. So they cut the chains off and hustled me out. And then began for me, and I'm not being facetious when I say this, probably the most exciting part of the whole experience. And that was a ride downtown through the crowded streets of this old Italian town in the back of a police car. We were on the sidewalk, off the sidewalk. People and vehicles were parting like the Red Sea as we made our way down to the city hall. And I looked at the speedometer at one point, and we were doing 140 kilometers an hour. That's about 80 miles an hour downtown. Mm-hmm. It was exciting. Just so it finally made it to the chief's office. And he asked him personally, big mistake, if he could get my headquarters on the phone so I could report back in. And he turned to his secretary, and somebody had sent her for coffee. So he was stuck. And eventually, we got Vicenza on the phone, and General McFadden came over and took me back to Vicenza.
Wow. And so during that process, when were you sure that you were being rescued? Was it when you were taken out of the tent, or did you ever think like, hey, this is fake? And at what point did you know it was real that you were rescued?
As soon as the guy pulled up his ski mask, figured out that these were the rescuers like they said they were.
Yeah. And there was a guard that was supposed to kill you, and he didn't. I mean, was he the one that was guarding the tent? Like, I mean, do you think that he just didn't want to kill you, or do you think he didn't have the opportunity?
He didn't. Everything happened so quickly, he didn't have an opportunity to kill me.
Wow. Well, thank God.
As I walked out, the other four people in the apartment were all lying on the floor face down. And one of the girls started crying. And one of the NOCs, N-O-C-S, the Italian State Police SWAT team, put his foot on her head and shut her up. But that's the first time I had seen any of them without their mask on.
Wait, so did they shoot the hostage takers? You said that they shot her, or they just roughed him up?
No, they arrested him. And the Italians had a law at that time called the penitence law, la legge del penitenti. And that law said that if you cooperated with the police, then whatever sentence you got was automatically cut in half. So they took advantage of that. And Savasta, who was the leader of the kidnapping team, really took advantage of it. And as a result of his help, some 100 or so key members of the Red Brigade were arrested. And arms caches were found all over Italy with some of which contained these surfaced air missiles.
Yeah, they had some hardcore weapons. They had some automatic weapons, surfaced air missiles, explosives. Like, it was...
Yeah, I'm sorry I can't show you the slideshow that when I talk about this. It had pictures. There were a lot of explosives and other weapons in the apartment. It was a veritable arsenal.
Yeah. Yeah, and they had killed like 100 people. The Red Brigade. So they were no small outfit. Like, they were serious.
They were deadly.
Now, so when you were rescued, and so you know you're brought back to the U.S. post there in northern Italy, and then you were able to talk to President Reagan. Can you kind of tell us about that phone call, how he was toward you? And
in the hospital at Vicenza, they gave me a medical checkup. And I was getting a shave, and somebody came in and said, President Reagan is on the phone. And so anyhow, they handed me the phone, and sure enough, it was Reagan. He wanted to know how I was being taken care of, and I told him, fine. And then he said, by the way, can you come back to the United States next week? I'd like to go to the National Prayer Breakfast with you. And I told him, I'm sorry, sir. I've been out of the loop for about 6 weeks, and I've got a lot of catching up to do. And he said, I understand.
He turned down President Reagan. That's funny.
learned very quickly, you don't tell the president no. So within about 15 minutes, I got a call from the chief of staff's office that said, get your butt back to the United States as soon as you can. And they said, we'll help you. So I went to the National Prayer Breakfast with the president. And I kept thinking about my income tax records. This was February, and income tax time was fast approaching. So I thought, I'll just go straight to the top with this problem. So I did, and I told the president about it, and he just said, good luck. So I filed for an extension, turned them in a little bit later.
Even the president couldn't fight the IRS.
I have a slide that shows terrorist organizations, and I put the IRS right in there. Yeah.
If you look at the number of people they terrorize, I think you're probably correct. You know, that's funny.
That was about the end of the story. And then the Italians wanted me out of there. The army wanted me to stay and finish my tour. So there was a compromise. I had been scheduled to go up to Europe to be an assistant division commander. So we started packing up the household goods, and all of a sudden, I was not going to Germany anymore. I was going back to the United States. So the president of Italy, Pertini, was scheduled for a state dinner at the White House. So I'd been invited back to that and attended that. So that was the second time with the president.
Wow. What'd you think of him? And
he's one of my heroes. I think his foreign policy was mm-hmm. right on. I've just finished reading a book about some of the turbulence in the administration. Mm-hmm. But I have been through his library out in California, and I thought his approach to our adversaries at that time was right on yeah. target. The stronger you are, the better you are. And
yeah.
one of the jobs I had when I first came back was rebuilding the army after Vietnam. And that was his job, to rebuild our national defense establishment.
Yeah. And I'm sure the pride along with it as well. So, yeah. I agree with you there. Now, so kind of moving forward to today, you have a book now. It's called Finding My Pole Star. And can you, yep. you know, just how did you decide to write the book? Because it just came out, I think, last year, right? So it's a pretty recent thing.
People kept
oh, okay. That's a good reason to get them off your back.
So, I started writing. It was about a 3-year effort, 3 or 4 mm-hmm. year effort. So I started writing. My sister was one of the buggers, and also friends. So I wrote the book, and I don't know. You have to find a publisher. Mm-hmm. So a friend of mine, who had been one of my mentors at West Point, hooked me up with a publisher, and I think that's the outfit that you've been mm-hmm. dealing with.
Yeah, yeah. It's I haven't read it yet, but I've read summaries of it. I'm going to buy it. What are some main themes or lessons in the book, or just from your whole experience? What can you kind of convey here in summary?
Well, finding my pole star is a pole star is something that doesn't move. The North Star is a pole star. And I talk about the people that influenced my view of life, and there were a host of them, to include my parents, some of the people in the military, George Patton, Walt Elmer, and a number of others, teachers. And these are people that make up your psyche. And that's what finding my pole star is all about.
Well, good. Well, yeah, fantastic, General Dozier. Any last messages or anything you want to say here in summary? It's been truly just an honor for me to be able to speak to you. And I've learned a lot, not just about just history, but just some lessons as well. But any last words for folks?
Well, gee, I'd like to be able to pass on all of my experiences to others so they wouldn't have to repeat them. But you can learn awful lot from other people, and both good and bad. And I like to talk about my mentors, and I had a number of them who provided guidance while I was growing up. I remember my father, when I was 6 years old, used to use me as a bird dog. He was a hunter, liked to shoot doves. But when I was 6 years old, he gave me a 22 caliber rifle with a provision that I would clean all of his hunting rifles. He taught me how to use it. So that just one episode in the people who influenced me. He gave me a way to shoot birds out of a tree, but in return, I had to clean all of his weapons, sort of learn by doing. I would encourage people to read the book. It spells all this out in a lot greater detail if you will email me your address, I'll send you a copy.
Wow, well, that'd be an honor. Can you sign it?
I'll sign it.
All right. Well, Major General James Dozier, thanks so much for coming on and conveying the lessons. Like I said, it's been an honor for me. One of the reasons I love this podcast is it's a great excuse to meet some incredible people like yourself. So I really appreciate it, and we'll be in contact. So thank you.
You must have a very interesting job, and obviously you enjoy it.
Yeah.
So
I do.
And I've enjoyed this session, and hopefully it'll be useful.
It definitely will be. I'm actually sitting in a high-rise hotel right now in New York City. I'm on a layover, so it's really quite the, you know, if you can kind of picture it, I'm talking to a major general, a war hero, you know, a fixture of history in America, and I'm here, you know, staring at high-rise buildings in New York. So it's quite the the image.
Send me your mailing address, and I'll.
I will do. I will do. All right, General Dozier. Again, thanks so much, and I'm looking forward to putting this out. And take care of yourself, and we'll be in contact. Okay.
Okay. Great. Thank you for taking an interest in this.
All right. Thank you.
You bet.
That's it, my friends. Thanks for listening. If you like the content and want to help grow this show, please click in a 5-star rating and friendly comment on your podcast app. It's the best thing you can do. And if you want to learn more about me and my guests, head over to gregcrino.com and subscribe to my newsletter. You can also follow the show on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Finally, if you have any ideas for the show or comments for me, send an email to gregcrinoshow@gmail.com. Take care and see you on the next episode.